are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, December 16th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. So casual that our typical Casual Friday guest, Cliff Schechter, is not even here. This week we'll be talking to the great Guy Lawson, author, journalist, journalistic author. Also on the program, ostensibly to give us a film recommendation, a guy who I don't know if he's going to make it, so I'm not even going to tease him. Maybe we'll have him next week. I don't know. Meanwhile, Trump goes full Netanyahu with his Israeli ambassador pick. One of his bankruptcy attorneys, who literally has not a day of diplomatic experience. It's not like that's a... That's not like that's literally the center of the most instability in the world. Speaking of literally, this new administration is literally made up of C-level radio hosts. I think I've officially now been on the air with like three of the people in the Trump administration. Four. I don't know. Well, we'll go through it. And this fun fact, Trump's 17 cabinet picks, as of now, have more than one-third, have more wealth than one-third of the nation. There's 300 million people in the country. Although that number could be dropping quickly as people head for the doors. Meanwhile, Trump announces, or sort of sideway announces, that he's not going to divest. Trust him.
No.
Not going to do it. Dems are threatening impeachment, but
no.
They can't do much about it without the Republicans. And speaking of Republicans, North Carolina becomes North Coolina.
Womp, womp.
I don't know. What's happening there is just, it's just god-awful, disgusting, just unprecedented. The legislature is going to, I imagine, pass their final law today, this afternoon. Meanwhile, Syria has halted the Aleppo evacuation because we don't have enough horribleness on the planet today. And Obama will not release the CIA report on torture. The good news is he will put it in his archives so the Republicans can't destroy it, which was the plan that I think it was Burr had if he took over the Intelligence Committee. I don't know. I mean, and then, you know, I've got a whole stack full of different Russia and CIA and FBI articles, and I'll be honest with you, I can't make ni heads nor tail. I honestly don't know. Now, Obama's said today that they're going to retaliate against Russia. Maybe before he leaves office, maybe not. I see that he's going to archive but not destroy the CIA torture or the report I got to be
such
honest with you,
Obama
folks.
Such an Obama move. Classic.
Well, I'm sorry. The first thing that I saw when I saw that was not just that it was an Obama move. At the very least, at least he's protecting these things. But I also wonder, what's the negotiation with the CIA? You know, it's very difficult to suss out the various motives that are operable with all this stuff about the Russian hacking, the CIA reports, the reports of the FBI basically, having some fundamental problem with the integrity of their process. John Podesta wrote a piece saying something's, rotten in the core of the FBI. And I got to think, my first reaction, I didn't read the piece. My first reaction is he really, honestly, the only person who can write that? It may be easy to dismiss it coming from him. Like what, they couldn't get James Comey's ex-wife to write this piece? So I don't know. But here is Barack Obama on with NPR's Steve Inskeep, who I can't even take seriously anymore since that exchange with the woman who worked with Flynn. Wasn't he?
Sarah Chase and Steve Inskeep, yep.
Where he said, so.
What's he like in the office?
What was he like in the office? And how was it? What was your first reaction when Flynn was appointed? My heart sank. What? Why? Well, because he's completely unsuited for this job. Well, we're out of time. Thanks for coming on.
Sounds like a fun guy, though.
Here is Steve Inskeep with President Obama.
I think there is no doubt that when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, that we need to take action, and we will, at a time and place of our own choosing. Some of it may be explicit and publicized, some of it may not be. But Mr. Putin is well aware of my feelings about this because I spoke to him directly about it.
Not for nothing, but speaking of the integrity of our election, what are we going to do about the domestic threat to the integrity of our election? When you have rampant voter disenfranchisement, where you have obvious voter suppression in the form of legislation, in the form of not deploying enough voting machines and voting locations in areas that are specifically targeted, particularly low-income areas where people have less options for transportation. What are we going to do about that? Who did he call about that? But I'm sure whatever Obama said to... I don't know what they're going to do. Put in sanctions, and then a week later, Donald Trump will take them down.
I think we're really improving our relations. We should wind sanctions down.
Really, it's unbelievable. And, we're That's 3 days away from the pops. Electors voting. Who knows, folks? Who knows? I don't want to cite that psychic because I never met the psychic, but there were three of them.
Well, there
two
you go.
Were human, and one was a spirit
of
one of the mothers.
It was a spirit?
Yeah.
So that I'm going to bank that for three humans. So essentially five psychics said it.
To a certain extent, if you're a spirit, right, you're going to have more access to this stuff than
I'm
human
saying.
Psychic.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Broader range.
Speaking of psychic, you know what you don't have to be as a psychic to know that someone's going to love Shari's Berries. Well, you didn't like that segue?
No, Sam, that was an amazing segue.
Why'd you go into Peter Thiel for that?
Because it was such a lame segue that I'm going to shut down this program.
We are now officially, what, a week? Well, I guess 9 days out from Christmas. And I'm very proud of myself because I just remembered it's the
25th. Why do I know about it?
But Hanukkah's coming. And frankly, not just as a gift, but you're going to have people over. I know, Michael, you'll entertain from the 25th all the way up to New Year's. People will be coming over, have a nice glass of Chablis with you.
That's
indeed. Maybe do some meditation, put on some of that yoga music you like to put on.
He's almost in tears. He's like, he listens to Ravi Shankar.
Yeah, so you can listen. But honestly, these Sherry's berries, huge strawberries. I'm looking right now on their website. It's driving me insane. You get berries dipped in white chocolate, milk chocolate, dark chocolate, with little like crunchy things. The strawberries are massive. They're delicious. They're fresh. It's a unique gift that is great for sharing. And it's also a great to put it on the table when people come over. And they're conversation pieces, but they're also delicious. When we got the Sherry's berries here, they lasted. I made it home with a couple for Nikki and Myla and Saul, and I was a hero. Seriously. I'm just like
low bar getting in the Cedar household.
I'm getting sentimental about that one time. But you can get an amazing deal, $19.99, for a half dozen gourmet dipped fancy strawberries. And you can double it, a dozen, for $24.99 by going to berries.com, berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in my code. That's the first thing you got to do when you land there. And that'll take you to the page with our deals. Folks, it'll take you, believe me, 5 seconds, you take a look at those pictures of those strawberries, and you will order it. And know that those strawberries, they taste as good as they look. Go to Sherry's Berries. It's berries.com, berries.com. Click in the on the microphone up in the top right-hand corner. Put in my code Majority Report and order them today. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Guy Lawson will be with us. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, it is always a huge pleasure for me, a personal and a professional pleasure, to welcome our next guest to the program, author, journalist, multi New York Times bestselling author. How do people say that, Guy?
I don't know. That just like you did, I guess, pretty much.
Of course, Octopus is one of my favorites, Brotherhoods. And the most recent, we knew it as Arms and the Dudes, but is now War Dogs because of the massive success of that movie that's based on your
streaming
book.
Streaming now on airplanes and
I saw the movie. I watched the movie a couple of weeks ago. It was good. It's not as good as the book, with all due respect to the filmmakers. But
you know, I'm gonna just respectfully agree.
All right.
But I think the thing about the book, which we're all about to experience in Technicolor, is I just believe in the truth, and I like the truth being something that is a good discipline and a good way to see the world. And I think we're about to experience something untruth.
Oh God! Yes, I mean that is. I mean, to a certain extent, right? The part of the story of War Dogs, or at least the part of your story, was sort of untangling the initial reports, which told one story, and then when you dug a little deeper, it was a very different story.
It was a story of what I thought was the Bush era, but I think is now in the current context taking on a much larger meaning, which is about the use of private contractors to do the kind of the bidding and dirty work of the government. And the New York Times, who I write for now, by the way, and so, you know, with all due respect there too, it's like the New York Times initially covered it as if these two young kids from Miami Beach had fooled the Pentagon. And when I reported it and wrote first a story for Rolling Stone and then a book, and then which became the movie, I discovered, you know, initially to my surprise, and then upon thinking about it, to my not surprise,
right?
To my unsurprise, that the kids hadn't fooled the government. The government had fooled the New York Times, and that the officials had been essentially using the kids as an instrument to go out and hoover up as much bad, nasty, and cheap ammunition as they could from Eastern Europe in order to dump it into Iraq and Afghanistan, in order to sort of do the war on the cheap, so to speak. So, but the thing that sort of really makes me think larger, and this is something you and I were talking about when we were socializing, is what's the sort of large way to think about the ascendancy of Donald Trump? And, you know, one thing I've been thinking about is I feel like Lewis and Clark, you know, like you're going to walk all the way across an entire continent, but we're just right now like at the Catskills.
Right.
We've just come over the Catskills and we're like, oh my God, look, this is huge. Like there's just endless amounts of area to discover. This morning I got an email about, and this is not to trivialize people losing their Social Security and their Medicare and race and all the things that are coming our way at a million miles an hour. But just think about this. I got an email this morning about weapons proliferation related to wildlife poaching in Africa, specifically rhinoceros and elephant poaching. And this is like a big problem because it relates to wildlife, but it also relates to poverty and lawlessness and the proliferation of weapons into rangers and just outright murdering, you know, in these countries like Tanzania and Mozambique and South Africa. And so this is like something I've been looking at to report on. The Trump boys went and hunted elephants and had this photographs of them online,
right,
with killing elephants. So you just have to stop for a minute and think, okay, well, so what does that mean? Like how is that recreational? And these are now like the first sons.
Right. I mean, it's Uday and Kuse. I mean, we joke that way, but on some level, there's like a lawlessness. I don't even know. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that's sort of the way I feel like we're entering into an age where there's no norms. So there's no, or the norms have been blown away. I mean, he's going to go in, and as far as we know now, he's not going to divest from anything. And the idea
that's the personal enrichment piece of it. It's just think about like, look, I'm a journalist and I'm going to have to cover this over the medium and long term. So I need to be careful to keep my mind open and my reporting muscles ready to be contradicted and be surprised. And so, you know, I'm like, I don't want to come across as like I'm in the bag, like cheering against Trump or all the people that follow him. But, you know, I'm a person with a set of beliefs. You know, I think that the personal enrichment stuff of it is kind of like a false flag thing. I think it's like this is the decline and fall, right? This is how empires change. They change with these little seemingly incidental things, with the FBI director and Russia and a terrible candidate in Hillary Clinton, and, you know, seemingly just a few thousand votes. But I think that they signify something much bigger underneath, you know, like the way the changing of the gears of this society, or the grinding of the gears. And, you know, this is the decline of white majority, you know, the white majority. This is the decline probably of, you know, basically truth.
Right. Well, but
the decline,
I don't, that's
the decline of like, you know, law and order in some ways, or at least the version that we've understood. You and I have kids the same age, right, Sam?
Yes.
Pretty much?
Yes.
Our children have never experienced, I know I have, after 9/11 and through that period of the Iraq War, like a time when the newspaper was just upside down.
Right.
Where everything was backwards, where just lying was not just fine, it was what was done by Colin Powell and George Bush and Dick Cheney. Just lying was part of the discourse. Like, of course you're lying. That's what you do.
And,
what you want.
And there was a sort of a broad sort of, there didn't seem to be anybody. I mean, frankly, I felt that way after the Bush v. Gore decision, which was like,
this
is insane. Like, and no legal expert, if they go back and nobody thought that the Supreme Court would even take that case. And the idea.
Did you come across this little tidbit from, I was reading about this electoral college thing, you know, the movement to try to get the electors to do the Hamiltonian thing and not let, you know, and there was a little aside in there. Apparently, at the time of Bush v. Gore, the Republicans, Tom DeLay in particular, was preparing an electoral college, like coup d'etat. If the Supreme Court had gone the other way, they were ready, or had not taken the case and the recount had come through for Gore, they were ready to do the very thing that everyone now would say would be a nuclear bomb, which points, I think, to the kind of bewildered look on Democrats' faces. I mean, do you remember during the debates when Trump said, you know, you'd be in jail if I was president or something like that?
Right.
And Hillary Clinton goes, she just said, wow. And it was like, shouldn't you be a little more prepared than wow?
Or the reaction shouldn't just be like, whoa, look at that guy. It should be like, oh, my God, this is half of, theoretically, half of the country. Or to bring it
to people's attention.
Yes.
I mean, you know, this idea that it was, you know, that she should be president because he's, you know, a bad guy. That's like the worst argument I've ever, well, you saw what happened.
Right. But I guess that period after the Bush v. Gore, where it just all of a sudden the media, everything sort of fell in line on some level. I mean, there was a slow.
Well, how about this one? Here's go ahead. Sorry.
Well, but there was a slow. I think like degradation, like the Newsweek on September 13th, the cover was supposed to be about the riff in the Supreme Court. You know, coming 9 months later, and then of course 9/11 happens, and that's really the. I mean, that's when we cross a certain threshold. But my point, I guess, with the sort of the emoluments thing and him enriching himself is less about the impact of that in a practical speaking, but symbolically, the idea that that's like the first full on complete disregarding of something that we have all taken for granted, which is the president is different from, you know, Ferdinand Marcos, let's say, or, you know, somebody who's going to come in and just use the presidency to enrich himself. And then everything about the way the country runs is spun out from that.
So do you have any very active Trump people in your personal life? My wife and I did in another context. And the thing about those folks, at least in my personal experience, is they're angry. They're angry about themselves and their own. They're angry about their religion being not being, you know, in free fall. They're angry about women getting rights are angry about, minorities being specially treated, all these things they can tell you. But mostly, you know what I think they're angry at? You and me.
Culturally speaking.
Liberal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Liberal, educated people who, you know, were good students and, you know, are able to do things in life that don't involve being like a drone, work a drone. I think they hate us, like, above all else.
Well, that's why I try and stay away from them, so they don't...
But the point about that is, though, is that, you know, like, this... I think, you know, listening to you now about 9/11, that makes a certain amount of sense, but I just think about the impeachment of Bill Clinton. I think about the way that they held up the Supreme Court nomination of Obama, the election of Obama. There's, like, this is not... an isolated incident. It may be a culmination of things, and it may be like the nadir or apogee of a certain kind of trend in American politics. But this, to me, like this sort of it's like, here's a good analogy. It's the separatists of Quebec. Okay, this will sound a little strange, and I haven't thought it through, so maybe it is a little strange. But Brexit, or the separation of Quebec, there's this group that wants to do something, separate from Canada or leave Europe. And they basically arrange the world so that they keep trying and trying and trying, and all they have to do is win once.
Right.
Then it's game over.
Right.
Right? So they have one referendum, they win by 1%, and now all of a sudden the United Kingdom is leaving Europe with all that that entails culturally and immigration-wise and all the symbolism that that pushes towards the Middle East and all over the world. That's what it feels like here and now, right? Like, we win this election by 80,000 votes, and now everything is upside down.
Well, that is a good point. You know, like, to the extent that the vast majority of conversations around this are about that swing vote, okay? In other words, whatever that percentage is, maybe it's 1%, maybe it's less than 1%, maybe it's 0.007, maybe, you know, because Trump got the low propensity voters, people who hadn't voted in 4 years or eight years.
Josh Marshall makes the excellent point that she lost by a couple thousand votes in Wisconsin, but that was like 8 points less than Obama got.
Right. And that's all true. I mean, and she certainly didn't drive the number of votes. But in terms of the votes that he got, what I'm saying is that, like, what I think we tend to forget as we try and analyze why Hillary Clinton lost the election is that 90% at least of those Trump voters were there no matter what. That's the movement that has been growing. That's the cultural movement that was involved with, like, the anti-PC stuff and the hatred of liberals.
With Republicans. He did better than Romney did with.
Well, I'm not surprised, because I think a lot of evangelicals stayed home because they wouldn't vote for Romney because he was a Mormon.
Right.
And I think Trump got them because they, frankly, did a much better job of saying the Supreme Court. You know, had Romney had the same sort of Supreme Court situation, those evangelicals may have said, like, we can accept the fact that he's a false Christian, because we're going to get the person we want on the Supreme Court. And I think that's what they did with Donald Trump, too.
I think that what you see in Donald Trump is the end of the dog whistle, and it's just a whistle.
Right, exactly. And
anybody can hear it.
But all right, so
no longer a dog whistle. It's just a whistle.
So, I mean, how do you, as a journalist, like, what are the challenges in covering Donald Trump? And what is the, what's it like, what's the goal, right? I mean, because
it's like drinking from
a fire hose.
So, yeah, well, okay. So that, it looks overwhelming, right? It looks like, you know, like we're Lewis and Clark looking out at the whole continent. How on earth are you going to explore this territory? You know, look, from experience, you know, after 9/11, I felt as a journalist that there was no room for me. And time proved it out. There was no room for outsider kind of journalism. There was just, you were just gung-ho pro-war, and that was that. And, you know, conflating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda was, like, nobody could stand up and say that's stupid at that time. And that's what I wanted to write about. And it was illustrated to me that there was nowhere for me to go. So I wound up writing about, like, sports and travel
Right.
And steaks in Buenos Aires. Because I had, you know, I was getting married, I had kids, and it's like, I got to find it, make a loop. But then eventually I found my way to it, and I hopefully I learned some things that I can apply this time around to a big seismic change, which is the first thing you got to do is, like, look at what's in front of you. You know, we were talking about Masha Gessen, the Russian journalist, who's been writing for Rolling Stone and the New York Review of Books, and she has a particular perspective, having covered Putin extensively and seen how Russian the Putinizing of Russia and how it might apply to the United States under Trump. And I would encourage your listeners to read the New York Review of Books this week and last week for her pieces. Very informative comparisons and analysis. But one of the main points she makes is when a dictator, which is to say, you know, somebody who's used to just, you know, behaving in a dictatorial manner, which I think would apply to Donald Trump on some level at least, when a dictator says something, the first rule is believe them. So as a journalist, I just think that you cover what's in front of you. So I'll give you an example. I was the first person, I believe this is right, to ever write about George W. Bush as an evangelical Christian, to actually go and find his Bible study group and find out what he really believes and how he came to believe it. That, at the time, in 2003 and 2004, in the run-up to the Iraq War, was, you know, I was denounced and seen as, like, you know, that's unfair, and, oh, man, you know, it was like, that was, because, you know, the story Bush had put about was that he had come to Christ through walking on the beach with Billy Graham up in Kennebunkport, which was, like, the quintessential, iconic, transformational moment, right? Like, this is like the white bread way of finding Christ. But the truth of the matter is that he was bankrupt in Midland, Texas, and desperate with young children. And this guy was walking across the country with a cross on his back, like a giant cross on roller skates. And he was giving an evangelical revival thing was going on in Midland. And a special arrangement was made for Bush to meet him at his motel room. And Bush and his Bible group met with this guy, and Bush fell on his knees and took Christ into his heart at that time, which is, you know, that's a touching personal story. Did it really have, you know, relevance to what was going on with the Iraq War? Well, I came to believe it really did, because it was a visceral transformation that he underwent, right? It wasn't some sort of cultural or intellectual thing.
Right.
It was visceral. It was a change in how he felt and saw things, which I think as a journalist was an important thing to discover. And, you know, what was interesting was that I met with the guys who were in his Bible study group at the time, and they were all like astounded that no one had been there before to write about this. Astounded because they saw it as a fundamental piece of who George Bush was or is at the time. And so that's what I'm going to try to do with Donald Trump, is to try to first take him, believe what he says, and then try to understand where he comes by these beliefs and what are the implications, and how do you contextualize? How do you understand how Ivanka Trump sees the world?
But let me ask
seriously,
you.
Seriously, man, well, that's a first-order question for us now. That is more important than how...
Well, I think it could arguably be more important
than how the next Supreme Court justice sees the world.
Well, I think,
in fact, I'm sure it is.
It could be more important than how Donald Trump, frankly, sees the world. I mean, it seems
right.
Yeah. You know, well, there's two things that occur to me. One is that, unlike that era of 9/11, where you had to go into the wilderness essentially, and you know, I mean, I guess also you did.
I went to Buenos Aires.
Crime stuff, but unlike that era. From my perspective, you know, which was really, I mean, at that point I was making, you know, films that were falling apart because I was so upset with just the Bush v. Gore.
This is when you were discovering you were incapable of not caring about this stuff.
Right. But my sense is that now, instead of that era, where it wasn't until like 2005 where you could say something about George Bush, right?
I mean, it was the 2003. I was a little ahead of that curve.
Well, but right, and as was I, but it felt like you were alone. And now
didn't feel like it.
You were right. Okay, you were alone. But now it feels like to me that there's actually there's a large that people aren't signing up now.
Well, and that's the second piece of this, right? Like the first piece, I think, is to understand and chart to be Lewis and Clark. I mean, I don't want to belabor the metaphor, but to start taking data notes, right? Like to start describing what you see. Make a map, okay? And then the second part of that, is the second part of describing this new reality is making sure that he owns it. Because I think the number one crisis that's going to come isn't Trump making mistakes. It's Trump making mistakes and blaming others.
Mm-hmm.
He's a master at that, right? So the election, he'll only accept the result if he wins. So just imagine if he hadn't won where we'd be right now. What if he'd lost by 80,000 votes or whatever it was? So what happens when Russia invades? Did you see this book, this new book by the former deputy joint chief of staff guy?
No.
So it's a new novel, and it's like one of these like very lightly fictionalized novel written by this military guy. I'm sorry, I don't have his name, but anybody could get it in a second by Googling. And he basically has written a kind of a thriller that, according to the review that I read, it reads more like a how-to for how Putin can overrun the former Soviet Union in 48 hours, including now NATO countries, and that there's nothing NATO, literally nothing NATO can do about it, nothing. And the reviewer said, you know, something like, This is a disturbing book, and Mr. Putin should thank him for this, you know, this guide. But just say that happens, right? Just say that Putin overruns these republics, which he's expressed, you know, believes. Yeah, you know, let me digress for a second here.
Mm-hmm.
A couple years ago, sorry, I'll come back to that point. But a couple years ago, I went to a major national publication and said, look, here's three links. And these three links show that there is a radically different way of looking at history that's developing in the Russian, what you call intelligentsia or in power circles. And it relates to a way of seeing the conflict with the United States as much deeper and profound and ongoing post-Cold War. And essentially views the Chechenian and Muslim movements inside Russia as American-driven, CIA-driven, that essentially they did what they did in Afghanistan and continued it because it was working. Which is to say, just for listeners, when, you know, the sort of the Charlie Wilson's war thing,
right,
where they armed Al-Qaeda to go after Russia inside Afghanistan, the argument that these Russian historians and intellectuals were making was that campaign continued in Chechnya and that there's a direct line between those events. Sounds kind of kooky and everything, right? But it's like, I was like, I would like to go report that. And this publication said to me, well, do you speak Russian? As if that was the point. And are you a Russian expert? And I was like, the reason to do this is because the Russian experts aren't looking at it.
Right.
And that went away. So what I think, you know, that's just a good example of, you know, trying to, as a reporter, find those cracks and fissures, to try to find the ideas underneath things and then try to understand them. So to return to this Putin thing, just say that Putin has this idea of this Russian rump throughout Eastern Europe, like in the Ukraine, and he's going to take Crimea, and then he's going to take another bit of Ukraine, and on it goes. At some point, it's going to become evident that Russia's not America's friend, right? Like at some point, when Putin's on the border of Germany, say, or Poland, like, you know, as if these historical events we're immune from them now.
Right.
You know, that's kind of how we've been living, right? Like, none of that continental war stuff happens to us. Well, why is that precisely?
Well, this is
so when that happens. Sorry.
This is the big test, right? I mean, like, is it, you know, and I think particularly for the left, which Or I should say, yeah, I mean, traditionally the left, I think, has thought less about foreign policy. Just simply, it's just not the territory that they're playing on. And the notion of the United States as a moderating force in the world, I feel like that that theory, that hypothesis is going to be tested in the next 4 years.
Well, but the thing, yeah, so I was raised by my father was, you know, a virulent anti-imperialist, anti-American guy, right? Like really believed that there were no political parties in the United States. It was just because the Democrats and Republicans were identical. And I was raised in Canada and this, and I had this very kind of un-American childhood in a way. But here I am living in America and, you know, I don't feel the same way as my father really at all, but it gave me a perspective. So one of the things that's important to do is what you just said is like, you know, not reflexively blame America, but look at, the American example important and how is it changing and what are the implications? But I really think it's crucial. And I, you know, you just listen to the news with this in mind. It's crucial to make sure that the consequences and implications of what transpires are put where they belong. Just to change to domestic politics, you know, I read in the Times yesterday, and I was talking to my editor about this yesterday at the New York Times. Really, the first piece that I've ever seen in that publication or any kind of mainstream publication where they're talking to Trump voters about specific consequences to their lives related to their health care.
Yes.
And the loss of their insurance and all these kinds of cascading implications. And these people had no clue, none, what was about to hit them.
Yep.
This woman was like, well, Donald Trump is going to keep my Affordable Care Act insurance and we're going to sign up. This is in Kentucky. This woman was talking about, you know, in Kentucky, we're going to sign up thousands of more people. That's not happening. So as a reporter, when that doesn't happen, the failure of the Clinton campaign can't become the failure of our culture. You know, if it just becomes pointing at Donald Trump and saying, he's a bad person, instead of this is what it specifically means, this is what happened.
Well, we're going to see this, it seems to me, with the Affordable Care Act, right? Because they're going to try and repeal it. And there's going to be an extended period of time where they're supposedly going to replace it. But as soon as they repeal it, as soon as they make that intention known, you're going to see cascading implications for that. And the first thing the Republicans are going to do, it seems to me, is blame Obamacare these new failures.
They'll blame Obama. And that's the point. That's kind of it, right? It's like keeping track, the Middle East. So when Israel annexes the West Bank, which is what's coming, right?
Right.
And Palestinians become violent, right? If the line's not drawn clearly between an action and a consequence, then you really have trouble.
Isn't the story about the Trump administration, at least early on, it's not just like sort of what is driving the way that they think? Although I think Ivanka, it would be interesting to see what's driving her in some ways. But
yeah,
operationally,
well, that might be something I'm looking into.
but it seems to me like operationally, what's going on there? Because my feeling is, and then, you know, I'm just looking at this from the outside, having done no reporting on it. But it appears to me that Trump is essentially sitting in the corner watching Fox News. There is Pence and others are basically picking the team.
You can't make it up. Idiocracy. Everyone, I urge people to watch that movie.
Idiocracy, yes. And I think that they go to him with like a sign off on this, or maybe somebody gets assigned like, hey, put a bug in his ear about this guy. Make him think it's his idea. And, yeah, you know, some Bannon goes into a room with him and says, you know, blah, 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 blah. Oh, you know, what about that Jim Stevens? Oh, yeah. Okay. Boom. And that's the way this is going. And like, you know, look, we know, or according to John Kasich anyways, he was basically offered the domestic and foreign portfolios.
Yeah.
If he took the vice, there's no reason to think that they wouldn't have offered the same thing to Pence. And
no, of course not.
And I think it's the only way that Trump wants to keep being president, if it's essentially like, I get to cut the ribbons, I get to go out in front, I get to meet with everybody, and I'll let other people in the room with me, you know, and do the the annoying stuff, but I do the good
so
stuff.
So probably, if that's true, probably the next thing that I should get on an airplane and go and report on Mike Pence.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, I think, you know,
I don't know. I don't really know Mike Pence is. Do you? I mean, was that really a part of the debate? It's like all these massive issues. I don't remember Medicare and Social Security being part of the debate during the election, really. And I don't remember.
No, well, that was a failing of
Clinton.
That was a failing of Clinton, I think, in my estimation, because they just basically let him skate by without having any issues, as if electing Donald Trump would have no policy implications anywhere. And it was.
Yeah, she was sort of like, she's like, look at him. How can you do that?
Right.
Which is the worst campaign slogan in human history.
As it's proven out. Yes, I think so. And the real question is, it's sort of like, who is controlling, where is the centers of power in the White House? Like, what is Bannon doing? You know, because everything.
Jared Kushner. Did you read, you know, people, your listeners might not even really understand who he is. I'll give you a little thumbnail sketch, but that's kind of what I know, which is that he's this very wealthy kid whose parents bought him into Harvard, and somehow he got involved with Ivanka Trump and insinuated into the Trump world. But New York real estate is really where his connectivity is. And I've had some passing experiences with New York real estate billionaires in my little upstate town. And I can tell you that they begin with fury. Like, they start at maximal. They don't get there through a process. They begin with furious lawyers sending you intimidating and angry and crazy letters.
Mm-hmm.
So Jared Kushner comes from that world. His father was sent to prison by Chris Christie, and that, I think, explains entirely why Chris Christie is the, you know,
been so sidelined at this point.
The blimp on the sidelines. He's the Goodyear blimp over there, with deflating. No longer floating. But Kushner owns this publication called the New York Observer, which used to be in the 90s kind of like a cool, fun publication.
I used to enjoy. That was my favorite paper to read in the mid and early 90s.
Sex in the City started there.
Yeah,
it was Carrie. What's her name? Bradford or Bradshaw? That was a column in the Observer. They had this sort of, like, I never actually wrote for them, but a lot of people I knew did. They just had a nice, light, metropolitan feel to it, publication. By the time Kushner owns it, like in the last few years, and during the campaign, it was like reading Pravda under Stalin. He had these crazy young journalists. I would love to find out who they are. So these are the kinds of things that are gathering my curiosity. Who's Jared Kushner? Who are the people around him? Who's Ivanka? Who's Mike Pence?
Yeah.
And, you know, I found that as a journalist, it's when you ask with an open mind and an open heart what people believe, people around them will tell you. And if you report it faithfully and you don't take sides and you just say what it is, that can be very enlightening. For example, the piece I did on George W. Bush, I'm not saying it changed the world, but I do believe that it took to use the same metaphor, the dog whistle of Christian evangelical discourse and made it more explicit in the culture, even if it just incrementally, even if it was just other journalists who started to hear it. You know, because one of the things I did was I talked to some professors at Wheaton College in Illinois, like, when Bush uses certain language, what does it mean? And this professor was happy to explain what it means to evangelicals. So let's unpack what it is when Trump uses certain words or tweets certain things. What's he actually saying?
Right. And who is he trying to speak to? And then you start, you reverse engineer that as to why.
Yeah. And you get what you'll discover, I suspect, is that it's dense, that it's multifaceted. It's not like the cartoon version of what we get now. Like, Trump is just, you know, he's tweeting that just because of race or something, that it actually has whole bunch of historical and
It seems to me that it's also quite possible it's just sort of like on a whim, and the guy's not being that thoughtful about it, right? I mean,
well, no, of course, I think both things can be true, right?
Right.
It's like, you know, it can be true that it's whimsical or, you know, impulsive, 3 a.m, but it can also be true that he is channeling something deep.
Right. So
those two things are equally true.
Right. The fact that he's in the position now as president, or even just the fact that he was in the sort of the titular leader of some strain of Republicanism in this country when he was the birther in chief, essentially, that it's his what he does is more of a reflection of a mirror to a certain segment of the population than
which
it is.
Which he intuitively connects
right.
to. So he doesn't have to sit around and have – he doesn't need – what's his name? Frank what's the language guy, the pollster?
Yeah,
Frank,
the ethically and follically challenged Frank Luntz.
Yeah, he doesn't need that. He doesn't need a focus group to go from, you know, to take the language of, you know, entitlement and turn it into the language of theft or whatever. All those things that guy did, that Luntz was, you know, an Oxford – I think he went to Oxford – graduate level intelligence. Trump doesn't need that. Trump understands it. He intuits it. To him, it's like hitting a golf ball. I'm not saying he's a good golfer, but it's just like he just knows. He just tee it off and everyone kind of hears it. But I don't know that I've ever seen someone take that on in a complicated and sophisticated way. I know for sure that Hillary Clinton was incapable of it.
Right.
Of explaining to the country what he really means and what its implications are. And I don't know how you define failure, but that to me is like that's as abject a failure as I've seen in my adult life.
I think that even attempting to do that is less relevant than attempting to describe what the implications of that is in terms of how people experience it, you know, with their healthcare, for instance, or
that,
with
no, that's
their,
what I mean. That's what
with
I'm
their
talking
public.
About. I wasn't talking about theoretically. I was talking about very practically for Hillary Clinton to say
they didn't want to talk politics. They did not want to
she
talk.
She didn't want to.
She did not. I'm saying the campaign did not want to talk
yes.
politics. And that's why they didn't include people like Paul Ryan in their critiques of what was happening with
right.
Trump. They didn't call them out for enabling him. They didn't call him out for, you know, you could assign him a position, a Republican position. It didn't matter. They just did not want to do it for whatever reason. And we can speculate.
Well, I think you got to stop at that for whatever reason and really, really unload that, because there are reasons, and there are reasons that relate to cultural and political and
yeah.
social indifferences that they just did not comprehend.
Well, I don't think it was just indifferences. I mean, my theory behind that is that they wanted to make a deal. They wanted to be able to moderate the positions that they had staked out in the primary. They didn't want to attack Paul Ryan because they wanted him to be a partner in several different sort of corporate tax reform and repatriation deals. And they thought they could win. And so why would we, why are we going to go scorched earth on these people when we don't want to really get locked into any type of political positions?
Right.
We want to be able to stay to the as far to the right on the spectrum as we can. We've taken positions. Bernie Sanders, pushed as far to the left, and we don't want to emphasize those things. And that's what they did. And in doing so, they basically just said. You start reading all these stories about these Trump voters who really don't their anger and their frustration and whatnot may be real, and you know people can have different opinions as to where it comes from. But they clearly had no idea what they were voting for. Like it's not.
Well, and that's that to return to the point I was making earlier. That's we can lament failures and James Comey and the Russians, and of all the people in this world that I find the most astounding is Julian Assange. How living inside the Venezuelan embassy is. Turned that person into just a crazy man. But anyway, you can have all those backward looking things, and I agree with you, Sam, that they deserve and need analysis. But what's crucial is they need to be shown now.
But let me ask you this. How do you reach those people? Like, what possible...
Make it up. Do fake news.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Make it up. You know, that's the thing. I was listening to this guy from BuzzFeed yesterday on NPR Fresh Air, which is an excellent show. Anyway, I like that show.
And must play before or after this one.
What's that?
It must run before or after this one locally. For you.
I love the fact that you can run this one anytime. Mm. So, man.
Nice one.
So this guy was on BuzzFeed talking about fake news, and I didn't really understand it, but like, there's a couple of things to know about it. It's basically a money-making enterprise.
Right.
They're just trying to get Google ad, you know, hits, and that it's largely foreign, which was bizarre to me. And what they're essentially doing was they were trolling inside Facebook, I guess, to find out what made Trump chat groups, you know, furious and made them link and share.
Right.
Because sharing is the way you get into advertising money, I guess. And they had hot buttons. They have hot buttons. You know, Hillary's a criminal. Clearly this sex scandal thing, there are things
right.
that they just will buy. And like, I think it's important to confess here to your audience that at some point during the campaign, I got caught up in one of these things that was an anti-Trump thing where someone shared or something. I came across like a headline, and I can't remember what it was, but it's like, you know, Trump bankrupted, da-da-da. And it sort of appealed to my worst instincts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It, like, it got under my skin in this way, like, oh, look, everybody can see now. So I think that I actually posted this ridiculous thing on my Facebook for like 10 minutes. And then I realized, and someone sort of back-channeled me, or I did a little more looking and discovered it was made up. So I don't think anybody's immune from that. But so you want to know how to communicate this stuff with them? I think that you need to not make news up, but you need to access these feelings and need to narrate against them. So, you know, what did FDR do? If you see this as a kind of crisis of that level, a Depression era kind of crisis, you know, who are the talented politicians who can really tap into it? And don't tell me Bernie Sanders, because that's ridiculous. You know, where are the young talents? Where are the people who are going to come through? And I have to say,
Why is Sanders
this is
ridiculous?
A big failing
in that
of Barack Obama. Barack Obama did not nurture the next generation.
No, I agree with that. But wait, let me stop you. Why the Bernie Sanders? Why is Bernie Sanders not that guy in your opinion?
Because he's 74 years old.
Right.
You know, you need people. You know, you need people of the next generation or the generation after.
Right.
I don't mean to be ageist about Bernie. It's just a fact. You know, like yeah, he has interesting things to say, and in hindsight, could he have done worse? I don't think so.
Right.
So, you know, I've admitted to some millennial friends of mine that were big Bernie people that I was wrong. I thought that Hillary Clinton would be a better candidate, more electable.
Boo.
And
there you go.
I know. But, I was just sort of practically speaking. I was not even – I don't vote. I'm not –
Well,
you know,
I mean, I think that's the hope with – I think the hope with Ellison is that under his leadership of the DNC, you're going to see more promotion and more – basically oxygen and space for younger people who are, you know, of the Sanders ilk.
But it better come on hard and fast, right?
Well, because, yeah.
You know, because I think that if you gain this forward, if you see, like, you know, for example, they move the embassy to Jerusalem, Israel annexes the West Bank and Gaza, or just leaves Gaza, and that becomes effectively the entire Palestinian nation. All those, if you see this kind of radical transformation, my friend Naomi Klein wrote a book about South American politics and how they used crisis in that context
mm-hmm.
to radically change the social contract. I can't imagine they're going to try anything less here to radically and permanently change the social contract, to roll back Social Security, Medicare.
Oh, yeah.
To transform business regulation, environmentalism, to just, you know, I in 6 months, this country is going to be just, as I say, upside down, different. And it's not good enough to have, like, this guy Ellison, I don't think, it doesn't strike me, like, can you name anyone? I mean,
no.
Ellison's the best you got?
Well, I'm saying Ellison, at the very least, is going to spread assets and resources to areas where, you know, certainly The Clintonites, and I would include the Obama administration, wouldn't be throwing seeds. But you're right. These things can't grow. You know, 6 months from now, I don't know who's going to show up 6 months from now as a voice of the opposition, certainly not in Washington. I don't think there's going to be anybody. I don't know who that person is. And
it's a failing of like epic proportions on Obama's part, right? That he threw down with Hillary. To me, like the things that we're going to miss Barack Obama, the country, for the stability and the sense of, you know, decorum and sanity and no tweeting at midnight and all that kind of thing. That's going to be like, just the civility level is going to plunge, I would suspect. But in the parliamentary context, in the British, Canadian, Australian context, the way that you measure a leader, one of the most significant measurements of a leader is how they leave their party when they go.
Right.
You know, does the party go into free fall? And I got to say, Mr. Obama has done a terrible job in that regard, because it's not just that Hillary lost, it's just name someone in his cabinet. Name someone who's got the liberal perspective, that has got the chops and the experience and, some sort of record of elective office. I mean, just name. This is where I despair. It's like, name someone. So that's why the burden on the press is so heavy.
There is no institutional, genuine institutional opposition, at least within the context of politics.
I mean, Jerry Brown.
I mean, again,
75 years old.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, my fear is what happens is Andrew Cuomo, you know, if Andrew
right.
Cuomo
or
has
Kamala
half
a, Harris or these people who are centrist, who are exactly right. The opposite of what's needed, who think
yes.
of politics is instrumental to their own interests,
yes.
and who trade against the interests of poor white people.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that I think that this leaves open, you know, if Andrew Cuomo has half a brain, he's going to take advantage of this moment, and it's going to be unfortunate because the people are going to rally around him just simply because there's no other options.
No, I don't believe that's true. One of the nicest experiences I had of this cycle was I met Zephyr Teachout.
Right.
For people who don't remember, she ran against Cuomo in New York State for the Democratic primary last go around. And she's just like kind of just a regular Joe. I mean, you were thinking about doing it at one point, Sam.
Hmm.
And then she kind of got the endorsement. I don't know if that's public information, but now it is. Zephyr Teachout ran against Cuomo in the Democratic primary and got like 40% of the vote with $10 and a staff of none. I don't see, you know, look, these trade agreements have been ruinous on some level. But hear me out. The policy of constantly enabling the downsizing and downshaping of working class white America, like just sending jobs to Mexico and China. Like, the Democrats need to develop some sort of answer to that.
Yes.
Because if there's no answer, and it sure as hell is not Andrew Cuomo.
No, I agree. Believe me, the last thing in the world that I want is Andrew Cuomo, an ascendant Andrew Cuomo. But you know, right. He has designs on the presidency. The best thing that Zephyr Teachout did, in my estimation, was at least kill those delusions, at least in the part of the political press. Andrew Cuomo may still have them, but he didn't get to get his 60% win as governor.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's going to be...
The only way Donald Trump gets 75% of the vote next go-around is if he's running against Andrew Cuomo.
I don't think he's the answer, but my point is there's such a vacuum right now in Democratic leadership that, you know.
Kind of bigger than that. It's Democratic thinking, isn't it? It's not even just leadership.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like policy. There's no policies. There's nothing there. And that is the gift, I think, ultimately of the Clintons, because they argued in the 1980s that Democrats had to basically become the third way. This is Tony Blair. And look what's happened in the United Kingdom. Labor Party's destroyed.
Yeah.
It's a rump. And that's what's likely to happen here. You know? So that's the kind of the larger frame context. Donald Trump ran against no ideas, none.
You're absolutely right. And he wasn't forced to at all.
I kept saying to people around me, just tell me one thing she's for. Like one thing. You could go to her website and they'd tell you this,
right.
You know, 200 pages. But just in terms of effective political communication on a national level.
Correct.
What, you know, Barack Obama was about hope at least. Like you could say a couple things, healthcare, hope.
Change. That's the
change.
Problem is that Donald
Sharia.
Trump. Sharia. Yeah, Sharia. Trump got the change. He held that banner and she didn't make, you know, she didn't even make like a stay the course argument. It was just sort of stay the course.
Not even really, right? It was more just like, because I'm a girl and he's bad.
I actually think it was just more he's bad. And then any other.
Well,
like
it started
sort of
out because I'm a girl. And then she let go of that, right?
I mean, I think I don't think that they ran on that, you know, as intensely. I think they realized that.
I don't mean a girl. I shouldn't say that. Sounds dismissive. I don't really mean to say because I'm a girl, because, you know, gender politics are vastly important. And I think it's a huge reason she didn't win is because she's a woman.
I think so, too.
That sounds cavalier.
I think that's too. But I think the bottom line is there was no real affirmative case. And to the extent there was, it was based on her personal credentials and both her resume, which was impressive, and her gender, which I thought was important.
How was it impressive, though? I mean, that's the thing. You know, so this is not to belabor this stuff because, you know, the poor woman, I'm sure she's not.
Well, I'll tell you how it's impressive. You know that story of Jared Kushner walking into the White House on, the day or two after the election saying, who here stays and who here goes? And they go, well, they all go. Well, in my estimation, the thing that she had unequivocally was an understanding of what's involved in that job.
Yeah, and an ability and a willingness to gin up any war dreamt up by any arch-right neoconservative. Let's not walk past
But I'm talking about her.
I know you're talking practicality.
I'm talking about what they ran on. It was her personal CV. And it was her personal CV, right? That's what I'm saying. Not policy at all.
To me, the moment that encapsulates the entire catastrophe of that candidacy is in maybe the first debate with Bernie Sanders, where he says to her, why did you take $600,000 for giving a speech to Goldman Sachs?
Right. She didn't think she was going to run for president. I mean...
And then she was astounded by that. She didn't have, not only did she not have a reply, she felt like that was an unfair criticism.
Yep.
Is that the one where she said that's what they offered?
Yeah, something like that. And she said, I didn't know I was running for president at that time.
Yeah. This is a game, set, and match. It's like, that is a person with, like, the shamelessness of and the money grubbing of is just disastrous, calamitous.
Yes. No, I agree with that. And which was a good reason for them to have tried to argue like, hey, if you elect Donald Trump, you might as well let Paul Ryan take your Medicare and your Social Security.
Right.
She
had no answer to that because she was spending all her time talking about her stupid emails and all this ridiculousness and to the credit of the Trump campaign, they knew much better how to target the negative with her.
Yep.
And I confess to being a victim of that to some extent because it penetrated my skull. It certainly seemed obvious to me that this kind of self-enrichment and kind of just preening self-regard was just going to play terribly. It's like it's just everything that you hate about Ivy League kids.
Indeed. Well, Gee. We'll check.
Dude.
Thanks for leaving it on the up note.
That's good. Hour here.
Yeah, let me do. Let's just have a little bit of a palate cleanser. We'll play just a little bit of this.
How is that a palate cleanser?
Well, this is. I guess now in retrospect, this is before the Nazis came, right?
What what are you doing?
Forced them out.
That's even worse.
Well, they ultimately made it, and they ultimately had a good life in Vermont in the Von Trapp family.
Great.
I was up there this summer.
Ski resort. So so there you go. Well, how about this?
I saw the Von. Is this one a compound?
Is this a little more uplifting?
There you go.
I think you should start playing O Canada.
Yeah, maybe. Incidentally, we need to talk if you have any connections, just in case.
Well, I know the Prime Minister, but I'm not sure that'll do any good.
Well, I mean, I'll take it if I can get a visa. Just a backup thing. I mean,
I'll actually leave your listeners with something that they have not thought about.
Okay.
I guarantee this has not occurred to any or certainly, if any, very few of your listeners. That there's a really big chance that the biggest loser in all of this kerfuffle at the moment, or whatever you want to call it, is going to be Canada.
What? You're so Canada-centric. Why do you say that?
No, because it's got the largest trade surplus with the United States. It's almost as big as China's, but per capita, it's like 10 times China.
And so what, you think Donald Trump is going to go after that surplus?
Soft lumber, yeah, oil, start taxing it. I do.
All right, well.
I do. I mean, it's what they, you know, the cliche is the low-hanging fruit. You know, New York real estate, to return to that theme of Jared Kushner and New York real estate culture, it's predatory. It's Manichaean. You know, it is about exploiting the weaknesses of others around you. And I, you know, as a Canadian, that it just seems obvious to me. I just did a little Googling around, just looked at trade deficit numbers, and it's Canada's got like 5 times or 8 times the trade surplus that Mexico has.
Well, then we'll crush
you. Hey,
we'll
Ivanka.
Crush you, or we'll become you.
Hey, Ivanka, what should we do about Canada?
Everything's going to become, everything becomes South Park eventually.
What does that mean? Are we going to get lower cost maple syrup? Is that what we're looking at?
I think what you're looking at is you're looking at tariffs on lumber and you know, having meters on pipes that are bringing oil and things in from Canada. Hmm. I suspect that you're going to see, like, this is the one thing I can say for sure, if you're shopping for real estate, like, don't get cute. Buy it now and lock in your loan rate, because interest rates and inflation are coming.
Well,
more good news.
Yeah. And then grab him by the pee, right? Like, what could be like worse than what we just talked about for an hour? I think that the journalism is going to be central to this stuff.
Well, we'll check back with you soon, assuming we're all still here.
Next time Guy's on, I think Obama is just going to insult him for like a chunk of the interview. that's the only way to ease the pain of these conversations.
Right. I think that the next time I'm on, I might well be. And this I don't know if I told you this, Sam, but I think we did talk about it this morning off air. But I'm absolutely convinced. And I think I can depress you even within this depressing conversation.
Oh my gosh!
You ready?
The first time
I saw Donald Trump hold a press conference, I watched it mesmerized, and here's why. The press in a press conference are typically in front of the candidate, right?
Yeah.
Standing in a room asking questions in every press conference I've ever seen. In the Trump press conference, and I am positive that this is not only deliberate, but it is very profoundly symbolic. In the Trump press conference, there was 25 rows of seating for his friends and family and people, and then 25 rows back in a holding pen like cattle were the press, and they weren't mic'd up, so you couldn't hear the questions, and he only took a couple of questions. It was an astonishing piece of theater.
Wow.
Watch it happen. Watch the next press conference. Just watch the optics of it, and it'll tell you everything about not just how he sees the press, but how the press has to pass through that has to close that gap, how it's incumbent on journalists to not allow themselves to be moved around like so much cattle.
Guy Lawson, always a pleasure. I'll talk to you soon. And folks, please follow Guy on Facebook and Twitter. This is crucially important.
I didn't even beg once this time.
No, but we will put links to both your Facebook and your Twitter handle. Because
And people should, I would encourage you not just to do it now. I mean, I've done it before, just sort of like the normal run up the numbers ego nonsensical way. But I actually would really love, because I know you've got a very smart and engaged listenership, I would love for people to share ideas they have about things to cover, because we're all thinking afresh now. And, just even in talking to you, Sam, I've sort of discovered some things that I'm going to explore in more depth. But I think that social media should not just be a way that we're victimized. It can also be a way that we can share ideas and develop new ways to see the world.
Great. People will come at you with a lot of ideas. Guy Lawson, thanks so much, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Sam. Bye.
All right, bye. All right, folks. Well, so instead of a light segment with what film should you watch over the weekend?
And another thing, I also think Canada is going to get neocolonialized. I can't even do that. And another thing, Sam, by the way, it was just occurring to me. Did you ever see that video of people being beaten in the street in the middle of Caracas? It doesn't matter if you haven't. It's going to happen here. That's after gold prices go up.
The nice thing is we have a good, a pretty large-sized Canadian audience for a show that talks about American politics. And to know that we're all going to be in the same boat, I think that's great.
Yeah, I don't think Justin Trudeau is going to be able to save Canada with his little woke neoliberal thing he's got going on.
You guys aren't going to be able to, you Canadians aren't going to be able to look down and just go like, oh man, that's a, what a train wreck
what
down there.
What a bummer. Looking pretty rough down there, neighbor. But soon we're actually just going to take your timber. Sorry. Ivanka, what about timber? What should we do?
It's going to be a very weird time.
Sorry, Melania's calling. Yes, Melania.
Do you think he would ever take her phone call?
No, never.
Never. Never, ever.
Do you think I ever be calling? That is real question.
Folks, it is your... we do have a Jimmy Arifa Cake song?
Yeah, it's called Exceptionalism, World War III Hypocrisy.
Okay, we will play that. Just a reminder, though, it is your membership that makes this show possible. If you're a member, you didn't hear the ads today, or yesterday, or any day, for that matter. But if you are interested in getting, for instance, the Shari's Berries promo, head over to, or just look in.
They're on the blog and on the show notes.
They're on the show notes. So you can always check that.
And what it is and you can just copy and paste the URL off of the show notes if you want to use it.
But the best way to support the program, of course, is to become a member. It's pennies a day, and your support makes all the difference to this show going forward. We're still trying to figure out, what we want to do in this different era. And it's taking a little time, but there's some stuff I think that we have some new ideas, maybe launching some other shows that we weren't necessarily planning and going in that direction. But, understanding what's going on politically.
Welcome back to the Teal Hour. Honestly, I'm Peter Teal. Well,
but I really do feel like, to a certain extent, we are, it's like trying to drink out of a fire hose. I mean, there are, Larry Kudlow is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. Monica Crowley is now, that guy Rhodes in the Obama administration.
I know who Ben Rhodes, yes.
Who was so essential in selling stuff that I didn't necessarily agree with. But
the Iran deal.
But also the Iran deal for the Obama administration. That's what that's her position. She's going to be that Ben Rhodes character. Now, Monica Crowley, they go around, they say, well, she was let's do this little test. Because I was saying this before the show. So, Kelly, you were not here when I was talking about this. All right? But let me read this to you. And you tell me what this sounds like to you, Kelly, okay? This is the New York Times, Jackie Kucinich's write-up I think it's Jackie Kucinich is at the Times, right? That to me? Yeah. Okay. Monica Crowley, Fox News personality, joins Trump National Security Council. And then the sort of sub-headline is, a veteran of Nixon's staff and cable news analyst has been tapped to be deputy national security advisor. I'm going to read the first paragraph, Kelly. Monica Crowley, a conservative radio host and Fox News analyst, has been tapped by the Trump administration as the senior director of strategic communications for the National Security Council, the Trump transition team announced Thursday. I'm going to go down a paragraph or so. Oh, this is the Daily Beast. Okay, sorry about that. This is the Daily Beast. Crowley's selection was first reported by the Daily Beast. Two paragraphs down, her career in foreign policy began as a foreign policy assistant to former President Richard Nixon. According to her Fox News bio, she is a member of the Council of Foreign Relations and holds a PhD in International Affairs from Columbia University. Now, Kelly, tell me what, give me a sense of what, based upon what I've just told you, Monica Crowley, what her relationship was with Richard Nixon, when she served, in what capacity she served.
I'm not sure, but I'm looking at her Twitter page.
No, don't look at the Twitter page.
Not old enough.
Well, yeah, so give me a sense from what I've written, when I've read. Her career in foreign policy began as a foreign policy assistant to former President Richard Nixon.
That she had a legitimate position in the Nixon administration.
Yeah. Well, you made the point that she's too young. She was born in 1968.
Right.
Her job with Nixon came when she was a 22-year-old college student and wrote him letters.
Right.
And she became his assistant in 1990 in helping him write books.
Can we underline that she wrote him letters? A 22-year-old college student was intrigued enough by a former disgraced war criminal burglar president?
But okay, Matt, I just want to note that. Michael.
Here's the problem, though. Is that her qualifications have nothing to do with foreign policy. It has to do with being an assistant for an aging former president who's been out of office for 20 years.
Why do the kikes not review my new China book? Get Crowley in here. The New York Times still won't review my goddamn literature.
The rest of her experience was to briefly write a column and then become a radio show host or a cable news host. In fact, I co-hosted with her one time on MSNBC in 2004, I think it was.
Wow.
She had a show, an afternoon show with Ron Reagan. I substituted for him. We were supposed to have a debate about a bunch of stuff, but that's when something happened with Deep Throat. And because she was... And at the time, she worked for Nixon. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was
totally
like, and I was like,
close.
Why would she know anything about Deep Throat? He didn't know anything about Deep Throat. She wasn't there contemporaneously. She was four.
But she was like, what
Not
a gross
even.
Man.
But I'll
Did
tell
she
you,
say that?
Her look at the time, honestly, like it didn't even occur to me when I was sitting across from her that, wait a second. She wasn't in the Nixon administration.
I remember one time Mr. Nixon and I were planning a speech tour for him to go to golf courses in China, and he was like, Deep Throat was a very bad man.
But the point is here is that she has no foreign policy experience.
Well, her job, read back her job title.
Foreign policy assistant.
No. In the Trump administration.
She's the senior director of strategic communications for the National Security Council.
Okay, so what her job is to cover up all of Mike Flynn's fuck-ups. That's her official job.
I think to a certain extent that's
what
correct.
What would you know about foreign policy, Sam Jew Cedar?
But the idea that people, but this gets to what we were just talking about with Gee.
The way it was reported.
She is not a foreign, now granted, it said according to her Fox News bio, but if you're going to write the story about her, maybe you should just go to the Wikipedia page and find out she was an intern.
She was an intern for Richard Nixon, then a radio show host. Yes. Yeah. Because she had a bizarre fixation with a creepy former president, which is charming in the case of Matt, but in the case of Monica Crowley, it is not.
And incidentally, you should also know that the senior director of strategic communications for the National Security Council, 4 or 6 months ago, was suggesting that Vladimir Putin should... get the Clinton emails that weren't released.
Maybe she won't be covering up Mike Flynn's fuck ups. Maybe she'll be elaborating on Mike Flynn's fuck ups.
Yeah, I mean,
amplify the fuck ups.
Exactly.
Amplifying, or, elaborating, and disseminating.
I think she's going to be looking and go, the question is going to be, is this a fuck up? And she's going to go, I don't think so.
Here's the foreign policy supply chain. Rex Tillerson, who is actually a very smart, competent person, scouts the world for even more places to wreck for oil and mineral deposits and governments to depose. Then on the intelligence gathering side, General Flynn's son runs the room. He's like, Dad, you have Kanye West, the fucking Illuminati. Look, I know you said you don't like other people music, but this is a big deal, Dad. Gotta get on the phone. General Flynn gets on the phone with Alex Jones to cover it. And then Monica Crowley tweets out, I guess the Russians are just going to have to release the
huge
Illuminati
breaking story
kidnapped
from Alex Jones.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it's going to work. Oh, here's the God. Loop. And then Tillerson's like, you crazy kids. Anyways, we need to invade Africa. And I do actually mean that as a continent.
All right, folks. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Don't forget, you can gift a membership. If there is no better gift for people who don't like to shop for their friends or their family than a gift to the Majority Report, because you can do it like you can do it literally just moments before they rush downstairs and open up their packages.
Ronald Reagan just tweeted at me. His sister is becoming a fan of the show because he bought her a membership. She doesn't have time to listen to every episode, but she's particularly enjoyed a couple, and she's getting into it.
There you go. Oh, we should also say thank you to Ronald Reagan, who sent us 4 bottles of wine.
He's the man.
You may not have seen those because I put them all in my backpack. But yes, it's a great way to gift the show for people you like, for people whose politics you agree with, for people whose politics you don't. Because, you know, they listen to the show and maybe they start to. So let me put it this way. If everyone in the country, if half the people in the country bought a Majority Report membership as a gift for the other half of the country, I feel like things would be much better right now. But we didn't have our gifting system set up before the election, and maybe that's on us.
It's like, no, MR broke it down. There actually isn't a pizza. Pizzagate isn't real.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half, and see you next week if you are going to leave us now.